To the set of all the segmentation tools that Ellie presented, just from personal experience, when trying to set one of these tools to hundreds or even like 1,000 individuals, for me it got tricky because it has lots of fine-tuning, and I decided to go with simpler methods. So what I was using was EMBC, which is, for me, it worked really nice. Maybe it doesn't work for all data and for all questions, and probably some of these methods work way better for the segmentation that you are looking for. But for me, that one really solved my headaches because it just worked really nicely with the data and with the question that I was having. So just as an additional tool that you could use. So now, until now, we have only used the geometry of the track to do everything and to look at everything. Also the segmentation, it looks at the geometry of the track. And now we're gonna have a look at space use. So how is the animal spending its time in space and where? We all use home range really loosely, and everybody has like their own personal kind of concept of home range. In general, we kind of have the idea that home range will be the area that an animal uses to maintain its own energetic and behavioral demands. Actually, the Burt was the first one that defined it in 1943, and he said that he would restrict the home range area to the area that the individual is normally using for its normal activities as food gathering, mating, caring for young, and that the rare excursions outside of that area should be not included. Also, migratory animals do not have one home range, but have one in summer and one in winter, and during the migration route, that is not part of the home range. And often young individuals that disperse, that are wandering around to find a new home, they don't have a home and nor a home range during that period. So, given the data that we actually have to calculate it, what we mostly are looking at is what is the area that the animal is using while we are observing it. So how do you quantify home range? Probably you all know there are many different methods out there. So I'm gonna go through some of the methods and tell you about the things you might want to take care of, because assumptions that several methods have, you really have to take them into account and not to have somewhat trustworthy results. And for all methods, mostly there is the trade-off between the temporal resolution of your data and the temporal coverage. So how fine-scaled are you sampling, and for how long are you sampling? So I'll be switching between the presentation and the script. I'll first show you how the method is done, and then I'll give you a summary of the method. So let's have a look. The first one, where is it? Here. So the script is the 7B species. So we're gonna use the bats, for example, and the first method that I want to present to you is the maximum convex polygon. So to use we're gonna use the function in AD habitat HR, and for that we have to transform slightly the data so it fits into the function. Because it's a bit picky, the object has to have a specific format, so it must only contain one column with the names of the individuals, and the names can't be any names; they have to be valid names. So there's this function valid names, which you can then replace all the symbols into dots. That's just, it's what it needs. So we're gonna use the individual 330 to calculate an MCP. And let's just look at this. So this would be the 95 MCP for this individual. And now if we look at area, we see something is off. It's impossible. I mean, this is a really, 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 really small area. And the thing is that AD Habitat assumes that your data are in meters, but we just use the longitude, latitude, so we use it in degrees, so it's calculating the area for degrees. It does not make sense. So now the question is, what do we do? Do we reproject this polygon, just take the polygon and reproject it into a projection that has meters, or do we reproject the points and then recalculate the MCP? So these are the two options that one could think of. So let's do both. Let's first reproject the locations. We take a Swiss projection and calculate the MCP. And the second option is to calculate the MCP and then to project the MCP. So if we plot this all, so there is, as you know, just so you understand, so as you know, RGDAL does not... is deprecated. So now to calculate the area of a spatial point, spatial polygon data frame of the old SP polygons, you have to transform it to an SF and then get the area. So just this line got a bit complicated, but I guess at some point it will get easier. But there you have it. So now you can see, let's see, we zoom in. You actually get different results, depending if you do one thing or the other. So it looks different, and the area is also different. So this is because the method, what it does, it calculates distance between the locations, and those distance are assumed to be meters. So always if you calculate an MCP, what you have to do is you have to reproject your locations reproject your locations into meters, and then apply the function. And that is the correct way to do it, and that is what the correct MCP will look like. And yeah. I'll run this and then I'll talk. So, because it takes a while. So the MCP changes with sampling effort. So the more locations you have and the longer period for which you have data, the size changes. The idea is that if you have enough data over time, there comes a point where the MCP does not change anymore because the individual won't leave that area and it won't get bigger. So here in this plot, so the HR bootstrap function, what it does, it takes one location, two locations, three locations randomly out of the track. I think the settings here are 500 times. And then it calculates an MCP for these random locations. And as you can see, this actually kind of reaches asymptote. So, I just read through this. It's not. It's in the instruction of this plot. But anyway, so you can see the different percentiles. Yeah, exactly. The 25. This would be the 25 MCP. This is 0, 25. I guess 0 doesn't make sense. 25, 50, 75, and 100% of the MCP, and this is the 95 MCP that we calculated with the data. So. If this line, when you add more locations, reaches an asymptote, that means that you basically have observed the animal long enough to be able, and that if you would collect more data, your MCP wouldn't grow. It's a nice way to check, because sometimes you can see that it just has a straight line up, and then you know, okay, the animal, if I would collect more data, the area that it's occupying would grow. So to sum up, as I said, it's mostly it's the polygon that contains the minimum area containing, for example, 95% of the points. It's a really simple approach. So it's really nice to get a quick estimation of the area that an animal is occupying, but the method assumes that your data are independent, that each of your locations are independent. It does not account for any kind of errors in the location, and it does include locations that might not make, it includes areas that might not make sense, and the intensity of the use of the space is lost. So when you do it, it's okay, but you just have to take this into account. In the example, I didn't thin the data, so the observations were not independent. So I was violating one of the assumptions of this method. So when you do it, just take this into account. And then always remember to reproject your locations into equidistant projection and then calculate the MCP.
How would you determine how much you need to thin the data by?
You will learn that tomorrow, how to thin the data so they're independent in space in this time, in this case. So the next method that I want to show you or talk to you about are kernels. So the kernels estimations, what they represent is the areas that have a higher value are those that have more use. So it does represent intensity of use. A really easy way of doing this is just to create, I'll show you the plot in a second. So what we do, we just rasterize our locations. It's really simple. It's a really nice thing to just get an idea of what is happening. So you can just rasterize your locations, but this, of course, is very sensitive to pixel size. So if here I choose a bigger pixel size and have 4 pixels, or have the pixels in the tenth of the size of this, we will get a really different pattern. So it's something that is nice to get an idea of how your locations are distributed in space. But of course, you have to think about that the intensity of use in this case could be only extracted if your data are regularly sampled, because if not, it's just number of locations. It doesn't have to do with time. It's just the number of locations in each area. If they're regularly sampled, you can also say that it spent more time here, because you have more locations there. And you also, if you don't have missed fixes, you just have this really nice regular track, just so you take this into account. There are two packages that calculate actually kernel UDs. One of them is the Area Habitat HR. And there is the parameter H, which I can show you, which can have different settings. And the parameter H, basically what it says is how tight do I hug my data, so to say. So you can set different values, and the results will be really different. I don't know of a way of knowing which one is the correct. I don't know of a way how to select the correct one. It's really subjective to calculate this, because there's no way to say like this is the best H value. It's subjective which H value you select and which one is better. Which one is a better estimate? I can't say it. That is a bit the downside of this method, that it's really subjective and not trivial.
Is there a way to calculate it with our data? Like, if there will be a way to say, like, yeah, what will be the best H value for this data?
I don't know. I don't know of a method that does that.
Okay.
Chris?
So there are different bandwidth optimizers, and asymptotically, they're all supposed to give you the same answer, assuming the assumptions of the data are being met. So when you have, in this case, the assumptions aren't being met because this is tracking data, so these are autocorrelated. So these are all wrong to various extents. And for autocorrelated data, there's only one bandwidth optimizer that's been derived, so you don't have anything to compare to. But for small amounts of data, let's say you had small amounts of independently sampled data, the different bandwidth optimizers could give you somewhat different results, and you could do some cross-validation or something to see which ones performs better. Mm-hmm. But for lots of data, they should have been the same. The last one here, least squares cross-validation, that's one of the worst methods for autocorrelated data. It's way too small.
So. Yeah, sorry, I forgot to say that the big assumption of this method is to have independent observations. That is the, yeah. Then the other package is the KS library that with which you also can calculate a kernel UD. And it's kind of the same. You also have parameters that you can choose off to do like the H value, but just the way it's coded, it's a bit different, and the way you choose is a bit different. So this is what is happening here. We are choosing different ways of calculating the kernel. And here you as well see that the different methods, they also give different results. And in this case as well, the data are not independent. So of course you're violating the assumptions that this cannot be trusted. Yeah, maybe we should change this example to make data independent and then have a look. Yeah. But so this makes it clear. First, make your observations independent, then apply the method. So to sum up the kernel density estimation, the kernel calculates the density of the locations, and it estimates kind of the probability to encounter an animal given the independence of sampling. The problem here again is that it assumes the independence of the data, and also it assumes that the sampling is regular. And if you put in data that are autocorrelated, the area is often dramatically underestimated. And also, the results really vary depending on the H value or on the settings of the function of the KS package. So it's pretty subjective, and there's no real objective way of deciding which is the H value that you actually need for your data. The next method is the loco. So, one second. It's a bit late in the day. So the loco, what it does, it builds small MCPs of the data and then joins them. And the way which data are selected to calculate these small MCPs can have three different things. So you can say, like, I want always to have a certain number of neighbors. I want to have all locations within a certain radius. Or I want that the sum of the distances between my closest neighbors reach a maximum amount. And this process is done for each of the locations. And then, like, all these little MCPs are summed up, so to say. I mean, the method is more complicated behind, but the simplification would be this.
So do you need to specify any of them, all of them, or is variable?
Coming to it.
Okay.
So the plus point of this method is that it actually does exclude areas that are not used, in contrast to the... No. Wait, this really takes a long time. So we actually have the results here. So just this script here that starts, so this script here takes a while to calculate. So to not stand here waiting, I already saved the plot and I'm just loading the plot. So here I used a setting for each of the three types of choices. And you can see that, I mean, the main areas that, so this is with, I forgot to say now, this example is with Leroy, the fisher. Again, we're going back to Leroy. And here you can see that the areas that are heavily used appear in all three. But
What is the difference between the A, K locals?
Yeah. So here you see the K argument. You specify the number of neighbors you want to include, because you do a little MCP for each location, and then you have to include like locations for it. So you say like, in this case it's like, I want 75 neighbors. So you take the closest 75 neighbors to do an MCP, and you do that for each of the locations. The R is 800 meters. So you say, in a radius around each location of 800 meters, I include all those locations to calculate the MCP. And then the A is the cumulative distance. So this would be 9,000 meters. So you want the distance to each of your neighboring points. So you take first the closest, then you go further away until you reach 9,000. And those are the locations for which you calculate the MCP. Now, there are problems with this. So the choice, again, of K, R, or A is not trivial. And here, what we have done is we have calculated each of the three variants with different values to see what happens with the area of the used space. So you can see that there is a dramatic effect of the values that you choose. And it's not that it levels out, it just changes. So this is also not trivial. It's not something that you can say like, oh, this is the optimal value. It changes dramatically. So it's also, again, a method that is really subjective. There is no way to say like, this is the one that I want to choose. One thing I forgot to say of the kernel UD, that the problem of the assumptions of being independent was not really an issue when the method was developed, because the observation mostly were independent, because you were going out and finding your animal with radio tracking maybe once a week, or with a banding, with having some banding, so it was not that big of an issue as it's now, where we have all movement data that are highly autocorrelated and everything else but independent. So to now sum up the loco, so it builds these little MCPs called hulls for each location, including the K neighbors, the R radius, or the A sum of the distances. And it takes into account that points are actually somewhat related, that are in a closer space. It excludes areas that are not used. But again, choosing KR or A is not really trivial. And again, it assumes independence of the observations and a regular sampling.
So just to choose like the same with the smoothing factor and also like now with local, like which one to choose. It's just that I see that on the literature, you will always find that many times in some research papers, it just appears, we're choosing this smoothing factor because yes. And yeah, it becomes really tricky. Like, yeah, how do you really justify? Because
I like how it looks, so I pick it. I don't know. It's in the end, it's there is no objective way of choosing it.
Yeah,
so you think like, yeah, this is probably the way the area that the animal is using is looking like, so I choose this. But that is not objective, that is subjective.
So it will be more like exploratory analysis that you do and then you choose which one seems to suit better.
Personally, I wouldn't choose any, but that is my personal, I actually don't use this method because I wouldn't feel comfortable choosing any of them because it's like, which one do I choose? It's like, how do I do this? So I don't choose that. I use another method because I can't. Yeah. Okay. Chris, you have something?
So as far as the local methods, there was a paper a couple years ago by Doherty where they took T loco, which has K loco inside it as a subcase, and they did cross-validation to see what are the best choices. And they didn't explicitly say this because I don't think they liked the result, but basically the best T loco, cross-validated T loco parameters is an MCP. It's to not do a loco at all.
Yeah.
Because it's being smaller is actually not helpful because the MCP is already a little bit too small in for most data sets.
I would also add that in this phase in which like they are transitioning to realizing that we should use different methods, there is still a lot of literature that unfortunately relied on old methods. But then if we want to add a comparison for future studies, it's probably still good to use the same. I mean, like saying doing a literature research is like this many papers use this with this smoothing factor. We are going to apply it to for comparison, but then we are showing what we think is a better method to do that. But then still for comparison. Right. But you could subsample your track to make it fit the same. I think it's just nice to offer like a comparison because otherwise we all offer new methods and new, you know, if we're, especially for conservation purposes, if we are trying to just see what is the likely home range for the species, and then in the literature you find all these different values for different population, but it's not really a matter of population. Often it's just a matter of the method you used, but then you will see how there are methods that are way better and they're not so sensitive to all these other parameters. And then you would, tomorrow, it's close.
Yeah, so the next method and the last method I'll present to you is the dynamic ground bridge movement model, which Martina, today, I'm losing track of time. So today, introduced it to you a bit, but with the variance component. So when we use this, we can use this variance of the track to actually estimate where the animal, to calculate the probability surface where the animal maybe was when I was not observing it, so between the locations. So this function is part of the move package still. It's the Bart Kahnstauber who has authored this, so who developed this function in his PhD, wants to improve it, but that takes lots of time. So it will come, but just wait. It will take a while. Because he said, like, if I want to transition it, I want to improve it. So, yeah. So this method needs also projected data, so you can't use the geographic coordinate system. You have to project the data because it also works with distances, and projecting the data reduces the distortion in the distances. And one of the easiest way to project your data is to center it to the track. So the 0, 0 of your coordinate system is the center of the track. So the distortion is minimal. Because if you use for one individual entire Europe, depending where you're, if the individual is in the edge of the project, of the area of the where, for which a projection is thought, there is more distortion. So this is an easy way to just project your data. This method doesn't care about irregular sampling, about autocorrelation, about it takes the data as is. You don't have to modify your data at all. There's lots of text here. You can go through it, but I think I'll tell most of it. So one thing that is important, because you run into waiting forever till this runs, is which is your minimum time lag? Because you think, I set my GPS to 15 minutes, but you have one location that is 0.1 second apart, because that sometimes happens. And the way that this method works is that it uses the minimum time lag that you have in your data set and splits it up into 15 little chunks. And for each of these 15 little chunks, it calculates the variance. And if you divide 0.1 seconds into 15, and then you do that on the entire track, you can imagine the amount of time that that takes. That is one thing that you have to take into account. Just look what your minimum time lag is. And then also, maybe you do have 1 hertz data. And doing a UD for 1 hertz data, basically, you will see the track. So it's not, or you have bursts of one. If you have the entire track of 1 hertz, then it doesn't make sense to do a UD, because you at all times know where the animal was. But if you have like these bursts, because lots of tags have high resolution data when the battery charge is high, and then they have lower resolution, so you have all this mixed pattern. And then you don't have to thin the data to remove all those 1 second locations. You can use, where is it? I saw it here. The time, it's actually like this. The time step argument. And there you just say, which is the time lag that I want to use to do the calculation. So you don't have to modify the data. You just state it within the function. I'm saying this because many people run into errors with this. And then going to the function. So in this case, we want to calculate a raster. We want as an output a raster with the probability of users with the UD surface. And for this, we can do it in several ways. So we can just state that the raster should be 0.45 bigger than the data, just to give a bit of space for the probability surface. Because if you cut off, if you take the extent of just the data, there is no probability surface that can be calculated beyond the boundaries of the data. So you have to always make it a bit bigger. And then you can just name the size. But you can also, if you want to then afterwards compare different individuals, you can also provide a raster and provide the same raster to all individuals. And then you can actually like plot all the rasters together, or do stuff with the rasters, because if you have one raster per individual that has a different origin, you can't work with them together. So this is just, And then the location error, we already talked about it earlier today. You can provide this one value. You can use an array of values that you can calculate using CTMM. Or you can use one value if you don't know it. But also in CTMM, there are methods to actually estimate the average value of a device, error of a device. And then we have the margin and the window size. And I will say now, don't really bother about this. I'll show you later on. That actually does not make a big difference. To just keep using the default values. So if we do this, so here you can see that you don't see much, and this is because the pixels of so the values of all pixels sum up to one. Because it's the proportion of time that the individual spent in a single pixel. So for example, the green pixel here, from the entire tracking period, it spent 3.5% in that pixel. So it could not at once, but the 100 times that it passed, whatever, so the proportion of time spent there is, in this case, like 3.5%. So this raster is really valuable if you, for example, want to calculate time spent in the forest. So you take a raster, 0-1 forest, you multiply it with this, but you multiply with this and you sum up all the values and get the percentage of time during the animal when the animal was tracked that it was present in the forest. So that is a really nice way to get these values of proportion of time that the animal spent in different biomes. You can also do it with continuous data. You take, I think it's the, you multiply it and you take the, I don't remember now if you sum it up or you take the average, but it's easy to find out. I mean, it's also in the vignette. I have explained everything, how one would do this. So this is a really useful raster for doing this. From this raster, you can actually calculate the UD with the get volume UD function, and this is more something that you're more used to seeing. So the areas in this case that have the are greener are the ones that are where the animal is more probably to be encountered or has spent more time. So just if you want to use this UD object, you can, for example, there are different additional things you can do it with it. You can just extract the contours and plot them on top of your track, or you can actually also extract, so as it's the old move package, it still works with raster, so you can extract the raster contours and make a polygon out of it, and then you can actually also plot it on Google. What is this OpenStreetMap? So you can make nice plots with the UD. Now back to the margin and the window size. So you've seen in the segmentation methods that there is often the sweeping window that goes through the data, and the margin is basically the data at the end and at the beginning and the end of the track that you exclude because there is not enough repetitions for that location to be within a window. And the window size, the smaller the window, you should be able to, the idea is that the smaller the window, you detect more breaks, so more fine behaviors, more changes between behaviors, and the larger the window, you will average across, you will only find like big changes in the behavior. But then, actually, when you have a look at, so here what we did, we used, just takes a while. My computer is already tired. Don't touch. There we go. So here, what we did, we took window size of, so window size always has to be odd. Uneven, yeah, odd. So we took a window size of 100, of 67 and 33, and a margin of 3, 9 and 15. And with just visually inspecting, you don't really see a difference. So for most data sets, don't worry about the margin and the window size. Just take the defaults. The only time where you might want to think about it is if you have really few data points and you really want to know with those few data points where the animal was spending time. Because if you have few data points and you have a too large of a window, then it won't detect any changes in the variance. So just that's basically the only case when you actually will want to play around with it. So one thing, so when you do a Brownian bridge, and this is in general for the occurrence distribution, which I will get to in a second, you cannot, the only way you can compare between individuals is if you have the same sampling frequency and the same duration. That is the only situation where you can compare individuals. If not, they're not comparable. That is because you have observed them during different times. If you have really high resolution data, the area that you calculate, because you know more where the animal was, so it gets smaller. The less, the lower the frequency, there is more, there are more areas with higher uncertainty, and then your UD gets larger. If you think about it, it makes absolute sense. I mean, yeah. The Branya bridge is a bit sensitive to, well, it's not sensitive, but it sometimes runs into errors that you don't straightforward understand why it's happening. In the vignette, in the move package, I think it's the move vignette, there is a section which is called common issues of the dynamic Branya bridge calculation, and there you can find the most typical errors and how to solve them. For example, one of them is that you end up with a really large blob, and that's because you have just maybe one segment that goes for a week because you lost a signal or because it was denning or whatever, and then you have this period of time where you have really, really high uncertainty because for 1 week, sometimes it's enough for 1 day if the animal moves a lot in the rest of the time period. You just have it. You don't know where the animal is. So for this particular segment, you get like this huge area of estimated area where it could have been. And when you put that all together, the only thing you see is a blob. And there's a solution for that. You can go to the vignette, and you just exclude this one segment that is causing the blob from the calculation because it's anyway completely non-informative. And then you can solve that problem easily. But it's all there with example code. So just to make a point of how important the tracking the different structures of tracks, so how often tracks, so the fixed frequency and the duration of the track, I'll show you a plot of simulated data just to make the point, if the plot ever. So we basically made the simulated correlated random walk, and then we shortened the track or thinned the track. And there we go. So you can see, so here the track is only 20% of the length. And here it only contains 20% of the locations, but it during the entire duration. And you can see that the longer the track, the larger the area, of course. But also the fewer samples, the lower the sampling frequency, the higher the area, and the lower the higher you sample your track, or the higher frequency you're getting fixes, the smaller the area gets. That is, yeah. No. Is it here? So the dynamic Branya bridge calculates the probability landscape between two known consecutive locations, depending on the amount of time it had available to go from one location to the next. Because if you're moving really fast, probably you're going in a straight line. If you're moving really slow, you could have been, for the same distance, you could have been wherever. And this is taken into account into the model. And the difference between the Branya bridge and the dynamic Branya bridge is this addition of having the moving window calculating different variances for the different chunks of the track, because the Branya bridge assumes one variance for the entire track. This method does not assume that the locations are independent, and it also does not assume that the data are regular. but the obtained area is scale dependent and it changes with sampling rate and also with the error of locations. So you really have to take into this into account, especially if your aim is to compare. You really have to be careful if you want to compare individuals. This said, yes?
So this is just a transient OOD. No, it's just...
Again?
There's a transient utilization distribution, this one. This
I'll
quite
go
similar
back
to
the, I'll come to the wording in a second.
Okay, so, okay.
So Chris, with others, some years ago came up with an identification of two groups, of two ways how to estimate space use. So one is the range distribution, and the other is the occurrence distribution. No home range anymore. You have range distribution and occurrence distribution. So that is more precise of what you're actually showing and calculating. So the range distribution represents what we kind of ideally have in our head as a home range, so the lifetime requirements of an animal. And it provides a metric that should be comparable between individuals because it's actually calculating the space that each of the individuals would need for its lifetime. And it should not be affected by any kind of sample size or duration of the track. But as we have seen, this is not the case for several methods. Actually, if you ask the developers of the methods, MCP, Loco, and the kernels, their aim is to calculate range distribution. Unfortunately, that aim is not achieved in most cases, given the data that we have. But the AKDE that will be introduced to you tomorrow actually does achieve this if your data fulfills a certain requirement. Now, what we mostly are calculating is the occurrence distribution, which is, where was my animal while I was observing it? To be more precise, when I was not observing it, between the observations. So in the entire period of time when I was tracking it, what was the area that I was using? So in this case, as I said before, you cannot really compare across individuals because it's something very particular for each individual for the time that it was being tracked. And it's not... even though it's sensitive to the frequency, it's robust against irregular data. So that is a really nice thing because most of us always have irregular data and these methods actually can deal with them. And two methods that do this is the dynamic Brian Bridge, which I just showed you now, and the occurrence, which will be introduced to you tomorrow. So I hope that from now on, home range is not anymore in your vocabulary, but it's range distribution and occurrence distribution. And you make this distinguishment so that people know what you're talking about. Yes.
So this estimation for occurrence distribution, is it right now we just did it at the individual level, but if you scale it up, you could do it for the populations or species level? And I'm asking because I'm not sure how that will compare to the range distribution. Is it a just individual by individual case base, or if it is a scalable?
I don't know, Chris, what do you say?
I mean, the range distribution will cover how that scales up to the population. So it's the population range. Yeah. But I guess my question is, what are you trying to get out of a population level occurrence distribution? Like, what do you want it to mean? So the occurrence distribution is given a random time in the sampling period, where is the animal located? Like, there's one distribution that answers that question. So if you can formulate a question, similar question for the population, then you can probably create a distribution that answers that question.
My question was going in the sense of like meta populations, like the sense that you have population clusters that will work, like they will behave differently, or at least in theory, they will behave differently and the occurrence might be different. So you can, in theory, scale it up to a population level that is not the species. So I don't know.
I see the problem that, so you're saying they're behaving differently, so they're using space differently. So you really have to take care, because if they have a kind of identical data, tracking period is identical, sampling frequency is identical, then you maybe can say something about differences. But if you're sampling one, you have a week, the other have a year, the sampling frequency, you have 15 minutes, the other once every hour, there's nothing you can compare, because you can't detect, you have different things that are being shown. Right, Chris?
Yeah, also, I mean, as Chris, I didn't really understand what would be the purpose of that, because if you want to do something that looks at what is the species, the distribution of the species, then you would have to assume that those individuals that you tracked are representative of the entire distribution of the species, which likely is not going to be the case, or the population, unless you tag the entire population. Or? Ah, okay, sorry.
Yeah, so tomorrow there is, for many things, CTMM is a really great answer. Not for everything, because the animals have to have a range resident behavior. If you have migrating animals, dispersing animals, you have to probably, but they also don't have a home range. So that is the classical home range. If you have migrating animals, what kind of, you have to decide. So So the answer for range resident animals is CTMM. For all the others, you have to make choices. Because they actually don't show the classical home range in that sense.
Maybe just because now I got interested in this conversation. But I mean, apart from CTMM, would that be, if you are interested in occurrence distribution, let's say, would you apply that? I mean, you cannot make inferences for the population if you haven't tracked the entire population, right? This is only something that you could do with CTMM.
Yes.
Okay.
Any more questions? So just so if you have animals that are not having a range resident behavior, and you're interested in something particular, you can always split up the track in different chunks. So if you have, for example, Ellie's example of the wolf, you can have your two range resident behaviors, and that can actually give you kind of a range distribution for those two instances, and you can also have the occurrence distribution for how it got from one place to the other. But it always depends on your question, always depends like what you're asking, what you're aiming for. So always think about the answer that you want, and then you find out how to find that answer with the methods that are available. So don't try like, I'm going to use this method and let's see what comes out. That is like, well, you can do that, but you will spend time and then you don't know what to do with the results.
This is more like a terminology question now that you mentioned to change, to stop saying home range and saying, say range distribution. I saw that in one manuscript on amphibian movement, it's being used that 100% of the MPC, it's going to be called movement extent. And so to be able, because our data is still a small scale, so try to account for all the movement of the amphibians while call it range distribution to 95% of kernel.
So I don't have much experience with amphibians, but I can imagine that there are animals that have a range distribution that is really small, because that's the space that they need. Yeah. They don't need to travel kilometers. With some square meters, they're completely happy their entire life and can fulfill all their needs. So that scale is not, you can't compare scales of different species, and it's like each species has their needs and has their scale. The other species need hundreds of kilometers to fulfill their needs. So it's kind of, So it's.
Mm-hmm. And nor call it movement extent, right?
I've so personally never heard that. But okay. Of course, everybody comes up with their own terminology. It's like, as you have seen, up to now, we have used different libraries that use all movement data, and each of them has their own kind of object class. because everybody wants to adjust to their own needs. It would be much nicer if everybody just had this one kind of object, but it's kind of everybody comes up with the same thing in a kind of a different color. So I guess like terminology, everybody comes up, yeah, I have this really smart term that I want to use now. So just stick to these so we all agree. Okay. Chris wants to say something.
So 100% coverage areas are not generally something that you can well estimate. So if you imagine something that's normally distributed and you sample it 10 times, and it's 10 times you sample a normally distributed location, and you make a 100% MCP around that, like there's no limit on how big that could be. But most of the time you're gonna get a finite area around the mean, roughly of some spread of the variance. But actually the true 100% coverage area of a normal distribution is infinite. So all of your estimates from the MCP, each one is infinitely wrong. So that's a good like example of how 100% coverage areas are not something you can really estimate well. So you should limit yourself to coverage areas that are not close to 100%.
So just getting back to that we cannot compare different individuals if we don't have exactly the same data. This is for the other models, not for CTMM, or is it
the occurrence distribution methods, because they are measuring where your animal occurred in that random period of time where you were observing.
Okay.
Range distribution, if you meet all assumptions of the method, because it's the lifetime, the space that it needs for its entire life, of course it can compare. Okay, I saw, there's a question, okay.
Sorry, just a scenario. Let's imagine that we have a lion population, there is let's say at least one individual of female per pride that is colored, same thing for the male, and to some extent I want to, would it be possible in that case do like a group of, a subgroup of the population comparison, saying the females cover this area, this range distribution, versus the male covers these other range distribution across, so comparing
the range
two
distribution
sexes.
Range distribution, you can compare as you like. You can
you can
compare the females, the males between individuals. You should be able to compare.
I know, I was asking if it's not between individuals but between groups.
Yeah, you can. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow you will see how you can calculate these population ranges, and then you can do comparisons between those.